This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Trying to lose weight? It's time to try Hers. At forhers.com/foryou, you can access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss treatments tailored just for you. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. This is episode 152, There Goes the Neighborhood. The narrative continues, so let's keep it going right off the bat. Last time we covered the beginning of the reign of King Antiochus II Theos, Antiochus the God, who earned his epithet when he reclaimed the city of Miletus from the tyrant Timarchus, a Ptolemaic rebel, and in doing so, started his time on the throne almost immediately with the Second Syrian War in 260 BCE. Although there was some barely documented combat in Syria proper, calling this a Syrian War is almost a misnomer. The vast majority of the fighting played out in Anatolia, and ended with the borders getting cleaned up a little bit. Ptolemy Philadelphus gained a little territory in Cilicia and solidified his place in Lycia. Antiochus regained control of the entire western coast by 253 in exchange for a lackluster marriage to Berenike, the daughter of Philadelphus. Today, we are going to stay focused on conflict, and not even really move forward in the timeline that much. Instead, I want to shift focus to the interior and periphery of the empire to see what else happened while Antiochus focused on Egypt. To start, we return to the northern petty kingdoms of Anatolia. You remember them. Bithynia, Pontus, Heraclea, Cappadocia, Armenia, Atropatene, and the newcomers Pergamon and Galatia, which perpetually sat somewhere between a Seleucid vassal and an autonomous principality. One of the overall themes to emerge from Seleucid records in the aftermath of the Second Syrian War was a solidification of royal control in territories that were already loosely Seleucid-aligned. Cities like Ilion and Alexandria Troas in the northwest had officially been independent for decades. Now they accepted Seleucid garrisons and adopted Seleucid coinage. However, in the places that had already fought to resist Seleucid control, they slipped away more completely under Antiochus Theos. To the west, Eumenes of Pergamon was busy consolidating his own power. He never officially claimed any specific title as the autocratic ruler of an expanding Greek city-state. So I suppose the most accurate term would just be tyrant, although his descendants would count him as a king. After winning his independence from the Seleucids in 262, Eumenes had to try and solidify his hold on the territory he claimed in battle, which was not always easy. Almost immediately, he faced potential revolt from some of the mercenaries he hired to fight Antiochus Soter. Apparently, there was a significant dispute over pay, and Eumenes bought them off with tracts of land. He gave the mercenaries control of two newly founded cities named after his father and uncle, Attaleia and Philotyra. Establishing new cities was also a way for Eumenes to promote himself as a Hellenistic power in his own right, participating in the same rituals and strategies of consolidation as the major kingdoms. Giving these towns to mercenaries may also have been a reasonable strategic plan. Attaleia, in particular, was built just a few miles from the Seleucid city of Stratonikeia, directly on the river route between the Seleucid border garrison and Pergamon itself. Whether because Ptolemy had no way to get money into his hands, because Antiochus negotiated well, or of his own volition, Eumenes made the wise choice to stay out of the Second Syrian War. This did work in his favor, and Pergamon used Seleucid distraction to push their borders a little further out, not with an invasion, but simply by establishing garrisons and gaining the loyalty of cities at the periphery of their existing influence. In Bithynia, King Nicomedes was happily ruling his self-titled capital at Nicomedia, when he fell ill and died in 255 BCE. Nicomedes' first wife had died years earlier, and much like Antiochus, when the Bithynian king remarried, he disinherited his existing son. That meant that there was no official adult heir when Nicomedes died himself. Ultimately, this would cause his adult son, the disinherited Zeilus, to launch a revolt and kick his stepmother off of her regency throne to claim the kingdom for himself. But before that happened, Nicomedes made other plans for the succession. While the queen would act as the regent on the ground, Nicomedes appointed Ptolemy Philadelphus, Antigonus Gonatas, and the ruling councils of Byzantium, Heraclea Pontica, and Chius to act as guardians for his infant sons. The smaller states, even a powerful one like Heraclea, were the only immediate neighbors of the young kingdom involved in this guardianship, because those were the states that were closely allied to the Bithynian kingdom, which could act as a check against threats from other petty kings. Designating Antigonus and Ptolemy as guardians sent a clear message. If the Seleucids acted against Bithynia during this vulnerable time, it would mean war with the other Hellenistic powers. Antigonus's participation, in particular, sent a clear sign that even though they were allies against Ptolemy, the Antigonids would not allow the Seleucids to monopolize trade from the Black Sea, as the Persians and Athenians had once done. Ultimately, though, the only one to take advantage of that weakness was another Bithynian prince. And so began the reign of King Zeilus. Zeilus's accession and his stepmother and little brother's flight from Nicomedia were arranged with negotiations through a Heraclean mediator. This relatively peaceful end to the Bithynian conflict backfired on Heraclea almost immediately, because Zeilus hired the Telistobogoi Galatians as mercenaries, They were then angry that they didn't get to plunder Bithynia in a civil war, so they raided Heraclea repeatedly on their way home. To the east, the growing kingdom of Pontus was also having trouble with Galatian raids around the same time, quite possibly the same Tolistobogoi mercenaries that had just left Bithynia, since neither Bithynia nor Heraclea directly bordered Galatia. Unfortunately for the local people, their leaders were in a moment of upheaval. Ariobarzanes of Pontus had just died, apparently of some sort of illness, and his son, Mithridates II, was still a minor. Apparently, whatever regency had control at the time did very little to combat the Galatian threat, and the invaders ran rampant in the countryside. Heraclea intervened with aid, exporting huge quantities of grain to sustain besieged Pontic cities. This, once again, irritated the Galatians, who turned around and marched back to Heraclea until the Heracleans decided it would just be easier to buy them off in exchange for leaving the whole Black Sea coast alone. The only thing we can really guess that the Pontic Regency Council was doing at this time seems to be negotiating with the Seleucids to try and arrange a marriage pact between one of their royal children and one of Antiochus's kids. But that did not come to fruition in Antiochus's lifetime. Moving south and east again, there were some interesting developments in Cappadocia, Armenia, and possibly Media Atropatene, though that last one in particular is hard to say. This time, we turn to another set of sources for the first time: Armenian inscriptions and chronicles. And somewhat more importantly, the modern historians who interpret them. The most important including Cyril Tumanov, a Georgian historian who wrote extensively on the histories of the Caucasus. I did find one reference to the kings of Armenia and Media in a description of the Second Syrian War, which is why I'm bringing up Atropatene at all. But Tumanov, whose citations are unfortunately difficult to track down at times, suggests that Orontes III of Armenia was involved in some sort of conflict between the Seleucids and Cappadocians at the start of Antiochus II's reign, probably simultaneous with the outset of the Syrian War. We know nothing about this conflict, but its resolution is interesting. Up to this point, while they may have been de facto kings and acting as such in their own territory and in negotiations with their immediate neighbors, the ruler of Cappadocia hadn't actually received recognition from the Seleucids. This changed in a powerful marriage alliance with Antiochus Theos. In 255, Ariamnes of Cappadocia and Antiochus exchanged daughters. A Cappadocian princess, name unknown, the sources are very abbreviated, married Antiochus Theos's younger son, Antiochus Hierax, meaning the hawk. Meanwhile, Hierax's elder sister, the Seleucid princess Stratonike, went to Cappadocia to marry Ariaramnes' son, King Ariarathes III. In a highly unusual turn of events, Ariarathes was made co-ruler with his father, but only the son was recognized with and officially used the Greek title Vasileos. Diodorus explains their co-rulership pretty explicitly, but the confusing use of titles occasionally leads some modern authors to assume that Ariarmenes had died or been ousted from power. Oddly though, Justin, our other main source for this, seems to agree that it was a co-kingship. This unusual turn of events simultaneously tied Cappadocia back into the Seleucid sphere as essentially a vassal kingdom that would only pay its tribute in military support, while also solidifying its position as a truly distinct and independent kingdom with no direct Seleucid claim on their land, as long as the dynasty continued. It was a great idea in the short term, creating a Seleucid stronghold in the northeast, and the long-term consequences of granting that sort of royal legitimacy to a breakaway state could not have bothered Antiochus at this point. There was just too much going on. Within Cappadocia, this official recognition by the Seleucids was seen as a big deal. It was so important, in fact, that it probably became the basis for their new dating system. The local Cappadocian calendar is noteworthy for dating its years to a unique starting point in the mid-3rd century. Over time, that date was associated with Alexander or the prophet Zoroaster, despite not lining up with either of them in any non-Cappadocian tradition. It does, however, align very nicely with their recognition as an independent kingdom. Back in Armenia, his involvement in the Seleucid-Cappadocian dispute that led to these marriages is one of the only things we know about King Orontes III. And given how much trouble I'm having accessing a primary source for that, I'd say the word no is a little too strong. However, one of the things we do know is that Orontes died around the same time as everyone else seems to be dying. It's just this whole generation of kings dying off all at once. Whether Orontes was killed or died of natural causes, who can say, but he was succeeded by his son. Probably. At least that's what their descendants would claim in their own genealogical records. The new king of Armenia was named Sames. We do know that Sames started his royal career as the sub-king of the region called Sophene, which encompassed the area between the northern stretch of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and even might have stretched a little bit further west at times. Following the example of his neighbors, Sames expanded and renamed a border city to fortify his defenses, called Samosata, named, of course, for the new king, Sames. Like I said, there is also a single reference to a king of Media, aka Atropatene, doing something in this period, but that's all we get. So I'll move south instead and back into the boundaries of the Seleucid Empire. Planning a trip this year? Imagine how much richer your travel experience could be if you could speak the local language. With Rosetta Stone, you'll gain the confidence to have real conversations and create deeper connections wherever you'll go. Rosetta Stone is the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language, on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. I don't have travel plans this summer, but the season has me in the mood for preparing. I've been to Mexico several times, and still mostly just know no habla. So I want to brush up for next time with bite-sized lessons. With 25 languages from Spanish to Persian to French and Japanese, that's a lot of you can learn faster and retain longer from. Rosetta Stone immerses you in your new language naturally, helping you think and communicate with confidence using an intuitive learning process without English translation. The built-in True Accent speech recognition technology provides real-time feedback, helping you sound more natural. And you can do this anytime, anywhere, with lessons from your desktop or mobile app. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. Remember how last time I said that Antiochus got off to a pretty confident start with no real wars or revolts to deal with in 261? That wasn't quite accurate, but it was close enough. The only hiccup was some sort of minor revolt in Babylonia during the succession process, possibly led by a noble named Seleucus. There's no source indicating that this guy was a member of the royal family, just somebody with that name, which was not unusual at the time. The tablets that reference these events are so poorly preserved that it's a miracle we have as much information as we do. This Seleucus was involved in some kind of Babylonian unrest. Apparently, there was enough turmoil or conflict outside the city walls that people moved their valuables and treasure into the city temporarily. And when it came to an end, someone, presumably Seleucus or whoever was actually leading this rebellion, was impaled on a stake as punishment for treason. Whatever this was, it did not last very long, and it's not even clear if it required the new king's personal attention, but in the West, everything really was calm initially. However, some sort of tension lingered in Babylon for several years. In 255, another person arrived in the city of Babylon, and we don't know who. It could have been Antiochus there for a visit, but the same tablet references a battle near or inside the city itself, specifically in the Eridu district just outside the Esagila Temple. On one hand, it's not likely that Babylon fell to an invader or rebel, and that fact completely escaped all of our other sources. That would be a big deal. On the other hand, Babylonian records tend not to use the word battle lightly. So whatever revolt or riot broke out in the city, it was quite serious. The next time we hear political news from Babylon is a full 5 years later, when enough of the tablet survived to know that Antiochus personally visited the city, which seems to have put an end to whatever unrest had plagued the region in the preceding decade. In all of these various disputes, including the Second Syrian War, we don't have any records of King Antiochus II personally leading an army. However, that is probably due more to a lack of evidence in general. By the time he came to power, the Seleucid family had firmly established themselves in Syrian Antioch and Sardis as the hubs of royal power. Antiochus would have been very close to the fighting, with minor engagements on many fronts, and at some point a Ptolemaic army very close to Antioch itself. We can assume the king did get involved somewhere. That was good, because it would have earned Antiochus enough legitimacy in the eyes of his nobles and soldiers to not go on a protracted campaign with them in a foreign land. Around the same time that Antiochus visited Babylon, he started antagonizing his neighbors again. First, he flexed his victorious muscles in Egypt's face by renewing a treaty with the Cretan city of Lytos to serve as a Seleucid ally. Lytos's closest neighbor was a city called Etanas, which was effectively a Ptolemaic naval base. Having Lytos on the Seleucid side effectively signaled to Ptolemy that Antiochus could strike this outpost at any time. Then, Antiochus ordered something that his empire had not done in a generation. He gathered an army and dispatched them across the Hellespont into European Thrace, while he went to Babylon. This was actually a very good move at the time. The Antigonids had lost their grasp on the region while they were more focused on Greece, especially when the Gallic migration passed through the area. Simultaneously, Gallic and Thracian pirates were able to run rampant from bases across the countryside. From a symbolic point of view, this campaign also allowed Antiochus to display that not only was his empire stable, but he was carrying on the dreams of their founder, Seleucus Nicator, the greatest of the Diadochoi who had been murdered in the same region. In that regard, it's no wonder that the invading Seleucid army made Lysimachia, now an independent city-state, one of their first stops. Technically, Lysimachia remained an independent state, which signed a treaty with the Seleucids. In reality, they now hosted a Seleucid garrison, and the Lysimachian mint produced Seleucid coinage. They had effectively been conquered without a fight. In fact, very few cities seem to have put up a fight. Kupsala, on the modern Greco-Turkish border, had to be taken by siege, but many of the local statelets signed treaties, though none was quite as fully absorbed as the Lysimachians. Instead, Antiochus ordered numerous cities on the Asian side of the Hellespont to start minting Seleucid coinage and using it in their trade across the sea. He just flooded the region with his own economic influence. Still, the imperial army marched on, going all the way east to Byzantium, which seems to have repelled the Seleucids. Byzantion would always be fortunate in that regard. Their position on the southern Bosporus meant that the city was impossible to fully besiege, and carefully arranged alliances with Heraclea Pontica and Bithynia kept money, supplies, and mercenaries flowing whenever the Byzantines were threatened. So out here in the west, everything is fairly stable and successful. The Seleucid Far East was a different story. India was mostly quiet in regard to Seleucid affairs. The Mauryan king Ashoka the Great was focused on his own conquests within the subcontinent. But Central Asia, this is when Central Asia started to break apart for the Seleucids. So now we turn to Bactria, as always the hub of political power in the region. Last time we visited this slice of modern Afghanistan and Tajikistan, the future Antiochus Soter used it as his capital while acting as his father Seleucus's co-king. The first Antiochus built up a new city, Ikanum, as the Greco-Macedonian outpost in his mother's frontier homeland. He consolidated Seleucid power in the region for years before returning to Babylon. And even from there, Soter remained directly involved in Bactrian affairs, most notably orchestrating the transit of soldiers, horses, and elephants across the empire to serve in Seleucus' final war against Lysimachus, and Bactria remained a critical resource when Soter became king. It was the easternmost Seleucid territory, on the front line of diplomacy with Mauryan India, and Bactrian military resources were critical in the wars with Ptolemy and the Gauls. It's just not clear what happened with the local political leadership in Bactria after Soter became king. It is possible when his sons were made co-kings, they took up a similar role to the one that their father held as an eastern viceroy. But as Soter became more personally involved in military affairs in and around Syria, it's also possible that his sons were based in Babylonia, just as their father had been for his own father. Regardless, when Antiochus II came to power, his sons were too young to rule the East as co-kings. So regardless of any situation up to that point, Iconium would need to become the home of a satrap, likely the son or grandson of a Diadochoi-era official of the same name. Satrap Diodatus was the man for the job. But something happened, and frankly, we don't know what. Antiochus's control over the upper satrapies began to slip away without a member of the royal family ensconced in Iconium. Diodatus and his neighbor, Satrap Andragoras of Parthia, apparently a local Iranian promoted to high office, were dealing with their own military problems in this period. And those problems had a name. In Greek, that name was Arsaces. In the local Iranian languages, it was Arshak. For now, at least, I'm going to use Arsaces for reasons we can address in detail some other time. Arsaces was a chieftain and warlord from the Parni tribe of Saka, one of those nomadic bands that had broken off from the Dahai Confederation in the early days of the Hellenistic Age. The Parni had been raiding deep into northeastern Seleucid territory for decades at this point, but they seemed to have grown bolder and more powerful under Arsaces, probably hinting at some degree of reunification under the bold and notably young new leader. At the outset of Antiochus's reign, the Parni were little more than well-organized bandits roaming the countryside between Parthia, Margiana, and Chorasmia. Over the years, as fewer military resources were available to the local satraps and Arsaces' power grew, the Parni became more of a threat. Fast forward to the end of the Second Syrian War. A decade of increasing tension and royal focus in the West all but required the upper satrapies to become more and more self-sufficient. They had to fend off Parni raids on their own. They had to secure their own trade. They had to craft their own stamps for coinage. And they were not all that far removed from the local rebellions against Alexander the Great and Seleucus. There was always a fear that the local pastoralists and peasant farmers would ally with their more nomadic cousins and drive out the Greeks and Persians once and for all. So local leaders like Diodatus and Andragoras had to solidify their own personal legitimacy. The Seleucid kings ruled the empire. Though the exact boundaries, capitals, and government had changed in recent decades, at these far-flung edges of imperialism, the empire was not wildly different in terms of legitimacy from that of the Achaemenids. Simply being the great king was a form of legitimacy in its own right. So the satraps took a bold step away from the central authorities in Babylon and Antioch and started minting their own coinage featuring their own portraits. Traditionally, as in by most historians of the last 150 years, and by Justin and Strabo's ancient records, this shift with Diodatus and Andragoras' portraits has been interpreted as a sign of outright secession. However, the last 40 years, and especially the last 20 or 30, have seen a shift away from that interpretation. Of course, you can still find academics who argue for it. There's very few things where that's not the case. Bactria and Parthia probably did not secede, at least not in a way that Antiochus II deemed militarily actionable. They did mint their own coins and promote themselves as powerful local rulers, but they continued to pay homage to the Seleucids to some degree and provide Antiochus with military support. At the end of the day, allowing these two satraps greater autonomy was probably a small price to pay for keeping their territory secure instead of having to redirect military resources away from Syria. Of course, I did say we have ancient sources that seem to support the secession idea, but they're both bad. Justin's epitome of Pompeius Trogus is just that, an epitome, a summary of a larger work, and contains more than its fair share of inaccuracies throughout. Strabo, usually more reliable, just seems to have some dates wrong, or at least used undated sources himself and guessed. Both of them mix and match events from Antiochus II's reign and those of his successors. Justin even gets the names of the Roman consuls wrong based on the other events he describes in the same paragraph. Suffice to say, neither is ideal. Yet, secession or semi-autonomous status aside, none of this was sufficient to prevent Arsaces and his tribe from gaining ground. As the Syrian war came to a close in the west, the Parnes stepped up their attacks in the east, going from simple banditry to openly attacking fortified Seleucid cities. Then, around 250, Arsaces made his biggest advancement yet when he captured the city of Astawane, modern Kucha, Iran, just south of the Turkmenistan border. It would be many years before the full consequences of this conquest and the increasing independence of the upper satrapies became clear, and I won't even get into it in the next episode, because there is some tension in the Seleucid court that we need to address. So for now, I'll leave you with this. A few years later, around 247, Arsaces' intentions became clear when, in true Hellenistic style, he renamed Astawene, or built and named an expansion to the city in his own honor, simply calling it Arshak, before declaring himself Vasileos, the king, or, as Arshak of the Parni would have said, the Shah. If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans, Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.